On March 15th, 2006, we are interviewing Mr. Frank Williams, who lives in Atlantic, Virginia, for the Chincoteague Island Library Oral History Project. Mr. Williams, can you tell me a little bit about where you were born and growing up in this area?
Well, I was born on Chincoteague in...
What year was that?
1923.
Okay.
And the house I was born in was, it sits right in back of Curtis Carpenter's house on Church Street.
Oh, okay.
And I don't remember anything about being there, you know, being there as a child, but the first thing I remember was living on Pawnee Island, and I just wanted to be on the water, you know, with my father. And it was during a time, you know, when the worst part of depression back in the 30s, you know. And the first thing I remember doing is going out on the water and catching mussels. One of the worst jobs in the world, you know. You got muddy, and it was just not a nice job, so not a nice thing to do. Not very enjoyable, but that's the first thing I did, see. And I caught a lot of things about it I enjoyed. And then doing different other things, you know. Nobody had any money in those days, see. So whatever you had, you know, was it was just like all the Chincoteague people had, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember doing different little things. My job, until I got old enough, see, to really get on the water, my job was to get the kindling wood in and help my mother and do things like that, you know, for her. Mm-hmm. And we lived right directly across the channel from where her parents lived. My father used to talk about, you know, when the channel was froze up, he'd walk across the channel to see my mother.
Oh, my goodness.
And they were married. My mother was 14 years old. My father was 16 when they got married.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of good memories about those days, see. But, boy, it was tough times, you know. If we could, you know, when I got to maybe 10 or 12 years old, I always enjoyed movies at the old Powell Theater. And if we were lucky, we could get 15 or 20 cents, you know, go to movies on a Saturday night. And, I thought that was great, see.
Right.
Usually see a Western show of some kind, Ken Maynard or Buck Jones. They were all big back in them days, you know. And but like I said, we had a lot of, it was poor, everybody was poor, but we had a lot of good things too about it. My mother was a real angel. She was the best cook I think I ever saw in my lifetime. And my father was a real hard-working man. Not a real big man, but boy, he was a hard worker. And he was maybe 5'9", but he had a big, you know, thick chest and was strong, and he's just a hard worker. He had to work hard, you know, to take. At that time, we had 6 children in the family, and later on, we had another one. She passed away a while back. She was only about 65, I think, when she passed away. But we've had our share of troubles, you know, but we've had a lot to be thankful for, too, see. And That's what I did. And the next thing I can remember doing is dredging oysters with my father. See, he had a little, Mr. R. Hudson built this little workboat for him, $350.
Wow.
He put a little Model A Ford engine in there, you know, which is what a lot of people use those engines in those days, you know. Either maybe a Model A Ford or a 6-owner Chevrolet, anything they could buy and put in a boat and make their living with. And like I say, he was a hard-working man, and I either wanted to be working with my father. In the back of my mind, I had a Coast Guard in the back of my mind, you know, all this time, see, because I had an uncle, Norman Jones, was my uncle, and he'd always tell us, you know, about the things he did in the Coast Guard. He was one of the old surfmen, you know, that was a different rate, and I can't remember, you know, serving... not as a surfman, but during World War II, you know, I got up to Assateague a little while, and I got to meet some of these surfmen. You know, some of these surfmen were still in the Coast Guard, and they were stationed at Assateague. See,
what is a surfman?
It was kind of a special rate. It was the people that their main job was to serve at a life-saving station, like the life-saving station is on Aztec. Mm-hmm. And their main thing they had to do was get out, you know, in bad weather. If a boat got disabled, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They had a 36-foot lifeboat there that was what they used mainly in rough weather. It had a leaded keel. This boat could turn completely over. It never did do it with me, but I know the boat could do that, and it would right itself back up, see. And they had to add what they call a picket boat. The picket boat was 38 foot long and faster, you know, had a little speed with that. Another little work boat, 26 foot long, but it was kind of a nice place to serve, I thought. And I would have stayed there until I retired, but the pay was nothing in those days, see. It was terrible. The pay was terrible. But I have a lot of good memories from the Coast Guard and going up and down the bays, too, with my father. See, you know, maybe getting sea oysters to plant either in Chincoteague Bay or Tom's Cove, see. When I talk about that, it's... You needed a boat that could pull, what we call it monitors. They were either maybe 500 bushel little barges up to maybe 1,000 bushels of oysters. That's how many we carry.
Wow.
And I remember telling my father, him and my uncle were going down the bay catching seed oysters. And I told him, I said, couldn't you take me down with you? I said, I'd go for $5 a week. And but later on, they took me down to bed with them, you know, and they maybe give me a dollar extra, you know, something like that. But very, you know, just enough to come home and go to the movies, you know. And I'd usually give my parents, you know, a couple dollars that, see, to kind of help things along a little bit. Mm-hmm. But that, and we rake clams. My father was a great clam tonger, say, you know, with tongs, you know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd like to say he was a strong man, he was a hard worker. I don't know how the man ever did as good as he did. Mm-hmm. But my mother, she knew just exactly what to do. If we had wild ducks or chickens or fish or anything, she knew how to clean them and to cook them and get the most out of them.
Mm-hmm.
She was two mothers in one package, you know, let's make it. She was something. And like I said, we could look across the channel and see my grandfather's house. He was like me. He wasn't very tall, you know. And he made a little bit of money on the water. And he got a contract to take care of government lakes once in a while. I remember one he told me about Fishing Point. He took care of the lake for 3 years. For 1 year, for $300 a year. He had to hitch his old horse up, you know, and take all that ride down to Aztec Point. And I don't know whether they would change the, whatever it was to keep that lake going at that time, said what he would do. He had this one little horse that he used. He could, you could put a saddle on it. It worked real good with a saddle, so it could help penning the ponies, you know, and all that.
Oh, okay.
And it would work at a cart, you know, one of those big high wheel carts, you know, that's what he had. And he had a little boat about 12 foot long, was all to make his living with. And Mom said he never had ever having as much as $100 in his lifetime. But due to the fact that they could raise, you know, chickens and guinea birds and ducks and geese and all that, besides a little garden, he tended probably about, I don't know, no more than 2 acres of land at the most. But it's surprising, you know, the good vegetables land would grow on Aztec. I remember eating things like green lima beans and corn on the cob, and it was all delicious, I thought. You wouldn't think so, when you think about Aztec, you could hardly grow anything there, but you could. And they used all that, plus chickens and eggs. And
So they were really self-sustaining.
Yeah, And they lived next door to a man, his name was Mr. Bill Scott. He had a little store,
Now, is this on acetate?
On acetate. Okay. Yeah, he mostly made most of his money by supplying ships, you know, sailboats and ships mm-hmm. that came in Tom's Cove due to stormy weather and everything. And they would get in touch with him somewhere, I don't know, mm-hmm. and they'd order mostly things like flour and lard, the basic things, coffee, sugar, mm-hmm. cream, and, mm-hmm. And of course, tobacco. Everybody loved tobacco back in them days. My grandfather, he chewed tobacco, and Mom would always tell me about if he had a little extra money, he would buy, you know, maybe two or three cigars. Mm. But he was a good man, and my grandmother, she was an angel too. See, she was kind of like I don't know how to describe her hardly, but if any of the kids said any bad words or anything, and my grandmother found out about it, she would never hit anybody, but she would set them down and talk to them. She said, "Grandmom heard that you said a bad word, smutty word, she would call it.
Smutty.
Yeah, smutty word. And most times she'd make you a cup of cocoa, so when she's getting ready to tell you these things. And she'd look you right in the eyes. She said, "Now, Jesus doesn't like it when you use words like that, see. He doesn't want you to use bad words. And boy, it would really get to you, you know." She would know. That was worse than a spanking or, you know.
You remember that.
Yeah, right, uh-huh. But she was something else. She could, anything that they could pick up, you know, like blackberries or wild cherries, she would use them, you know, to make jelly, or she'd fix them up some kind of way, sort of, you know, in preserves or things like that. And all of my grandfather's chicken houses and things like that, the outside toilet and things like that, he could find lumber on Estig Beach. He could go out with his horse and wagon, and instead of having wire fences, they would have like a stile. You know, you had to maybe step up this high, you know, to get up on that stile. But whatever it was, it kept the horses, and I can only remember him having one horse, but Mr. Scott had a horse too, you know. Mm-hmm. I think they would use one another's, you know, grazing property or whatever mm-hmm. it was. And, mm-hmm. But Mr. Scott, he was kind of a character. He was, he wasn't too dainty a man, to tell you the truth. He wore bib overalls, and he had a big thick beard. He smoked a pipe. And like I said, they would order chicken houses and coops and all that. They had all the lumber they needed to do the things they needed to do like that. And Mr. Scott, his job described, really, because his bib overhauls, he had patches on all his clothes and patches on top of them patches, and I think about more patches on top of them. And he loved a pipe. Oh, he loved, that's the only thing he had for his pleasures. It was his pipe. And I remember one of my uncles telling me, his name was Mordecai McGee, and one of the Jones men, see, but they told me about Mr. Scott got up one night and he had to go out and check his chickens and, you know, close them up or whatever he had to do. And when he got up, he laid his pipe on the counter, see, in his little store. The store room was, it wasn't much bigger than this room right here. See, I said it was 5 foot wider, maybe, a very small place. And when they laid his pipe down, one of the boys grabbed his pipe, took the lump of tobacco out, and took a gun shell, and took that gunpowder and put in his pipe and put the tobacco on top. They thought it was fun, see, but it was really a dangerous thing to do, see. And Mr. Scott come in, and of course that's the first thing he grabbed was his pipe. And they said it made about two puffs, and it blew the whole ball off in his pipe and singed his beard. You know, it's a bad thing to do, but they didn't really know what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And they took off running, and one of them said, we better get on. And just by the time they got down, you know, and hid themselves, a load of shot went over top of her. He shot at him, really. He was at, and I can't much blame him, things like that, you know. You hear about people doing things like that, and but a lot of it wasn't too nice. And in Murscott's case, it was just
he recovered.
Yeah.
I bet those guys didn't do that again.
No, that broke that little deal up. But anyway, that's the way things were on on Aztec.
Mm-hmm.
They could cut, get their own wood to burn in the winter months, and they mostly cut it's called a myrtle. Had got a sweet smell to it, myrtle
yes.
bushes
mm-hmm.
has. And my grandmother's kitchen had a special, odor to it, see, because that's the kind of wood she burned. If you had a good solid chopping block to cut it on, you could take a piece that big, and with a sharp axe, you could make one swipe and cut off little pieces of wood, that would fit in the wood stove. And they got all their wood, and Mom used to always talk about the things they got from the seafood that my grandfather had on hand all the time. He talked about oysters and clams that came from Tom's Cove, the best clams in the world. And mangoes.
Did you just get them fresh, or did you store them?
They could keep a few. A clam will live, if it's kept in the shade, or oyster either. They'll live a good week, so you keep them in the coolest place you can find. And but after my father died, she would tell me a little yarn about Aztec every day, during lunchtime. I always had lunch with her. And about how they made a kill, I think they called it, for potatoes. And her mother would send her out, They used pine shats and things like that for it, see. And she could reach in there and get all the potatoes out they needed.
Mm-hmm.
And always had plenty of seafood and fish. All they had, was that ball of fishing line, to fish with. No rod. My grandfather hit him with a rod and reel was. But they could push right off in the channel. See, their property was right down to Aztec Channel. And just get right out in the channel and catch all the fish they needed back in those days. And
wonderful.
Yeah. My mother used to say that whatever they caught, it could be a little perch or we call them little black wheels. You know what I'm talking about, a little black bass. Real good eating fish, but they're small, but they were good. They were tasty little fish. And, most time catch maybe some nice trout or things like that. And they could always get their bait, by walking right down the shore with a crab net. And dipping up hard crabs, see, and that's the kind of bait they used to bait their hook with, see.
Mm-hmm.
But Mom, she was something else, She could always remember these things, and her mind was good until, till she got, maybe 76, 78 years
mm-hmm.
old. He could take his horse and wagon and go up in the woods and cut, wood. Every chance him and my Uncle Norman had, see. And and another one of the yarns I always remember, my Uncle Norman, to me, he was special. He was in the Coast Guard. He was one of the surfmen. And he'd always have a little story to tell you about different things that happened. One of the things they did, the cook, he was a big strong man, see, but they played jokes on him. They caught a little live duck in one case and put him in the coffee pot.
Oh, my gosh.
And he come on down, the cook did, the next morning and lit that coffee, put the coffee pot on the stove. And he heard all this scratching, but the little duck bounced up and got out of the big coffee pot. See, the coffee pot helped probably a gallon and a half of coffee. But they did some ornery things, back mm-hmm. in those days, see. And,
that was their entertainment.
That was their entertainment. No radio, no TV. We didn't know nothing about things like that back in those days. But he was somebody I always looked up to. My Uncle Norman and my Uncle Mark McGee, we called him. His real name was Mordecai, but everybody called him Mark. And he was a great man. He was a good horseback rider. And him and Norman both. See, our whole family. We always took an active part in this. Pony roundup and swim and all that. And my father had a little speaking part in the movie Misty. His name, if you ever watch it, think about Lloyd Williams. And his buddy was named Wilbur Weave. He was a great boat builder, Mr. Wimbrow was. And they'd done a real good job, you know, taking care of the ponies, rounding them up, and working with them, and things like that. And anyway, in this speaking party he had with 20th Century Fox, my father, well, they kept his name the same, Lloyd Williams, and they changed Wilbur's name to Jess. And my father said, Jess, what time is low tide?
Oh.
That was the speaking part. And
his
answer was 10 o'clock or thereabouts. And they each got $100 extra for that. Boy, that was something big, you know. $100, yeah. And, but nobody, think about it, back in those days, nobody, you know, we had no money, we had no clothes, you know, if you were lucky, you had maybe two pair of pants, and sometimes your shoes were about as cheap as they could be, you could buy. They were always, the soles were sewed on, and when you wore them maybe a month, that thread wore out, and that was your sole flapping. But, it was just a lot, you know, to be thankful for when you stop and think about the days over there with your grandparents. And if for some reason, you know, they wanted well, we'd always ask them, we'd beg to get to go over to Aztec and stay with our grandparents. Because she was just, you know, so nice to us. And my grandfather was too. I don't know how he put up, but sometimes he'd have five or six kids in the house at one time, and but you know, no problem. And he would row across the channel maybe once a week and buy a few groceries. And when he come back, he had to tie up at my father's dock most of the time. And when he come back from the store, he'd always get the kids and. In our immediate family, a box of Cracker Jacks. That was a big treat, too.
Oh, okay.
And another thing we enjoyed was my cousin Roy Jones used to tell me about, he'd see one of the men from Aztec coming back from Shinktig, and he would go down to meet him. You know, he'd tickle to death to get down to meet him. And they had big cookies back in them days. I meant about as cheap as you could buy, but one of them had a white icing on it, like a gingerbread. They were real, you know, soft, real good cookies, I thought. And he would meet the people, and they'd give him one of them big cookies. He thought that was great, see. And another thing he said he would do, he would ramble all around, and some of the people would be maybe frying fish, and they'd hand him out a little purse, you know, or a little black wool, you know, fried nice and brown, but boy, said it was good.
I bet.
And just things like that. The only thing I can remember having, like a toy of any kind, was a little paper cap pistol. Me and my brother Raymond had a little roll of paper caps, you know, with it. And probably cost about, I don't know, 75 or 80 cents, this little paper cap pistol. And we'd have maybe, I don't know, two or three packages of paper caps. We didn't stop shooting until they're all used up. We're just so tickled to have that paper cap pistol. And
you want to take a little break here?
Well, I don't know. It was almost like a fire land being there, say, with them. My Goldie, my sister Goldie, she's still living. She's 80 years old, and but she. Her memory was better than mine, but she could remember a lot of things. And my grandmother used to tell little stories, and my sister could remember some of them. I can't remember hardly anything about those stories she told us. One of them was she'd tell this thing about the witch. It had something concerning a witch, but the witch would fly out the keyhole. My grandmother was telling her all these things. But I could, that's all I can remember about that story. And but we did. We had plenty of food to eat, due to, you know, plenty of seafood. And one of the things she liked to keep in the house, you know, was the buckwheat. She was great on buckwheat cakes.
Uh-huh.
And, well, mostly all the people in those days could make a nice piece of homemade bread, see. And that was a big thing in their diet, you know, homemade bread, real good. And Mr. Scott, he used to raise turkeys and guinea birds, and the turkeys could get almost all their living by going down to the shore and feeding off little fiddler crabs. They were rhyme by the thousands, you know, back in the days. And he had guinea birds, they were easy to raise. They could, another little story I remember, my Uncle Norman was telling me that later on he took care of the lighthouse, see, and he'd always stop in and see Miss Scott. And this day, Miss Scott had fixed 9 guinea bird eggs and give Mr. Scott 8 of them. And she fixed one for the little dog. Had a little dog named Lady, I think it was a dog's name. Mr. Scott ate all of his 8 guinea bird eggs, and the little dog left a little bit, and he finished eating it. Uncle Norman told me that. Norman's two daughters, Janet and Norma Faye, they own the Etta's, you know, the restaurant down along. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you're there, stop in and talk to them, yeah.
Well, that sounds
they're
like
both
a good
too
suggestion.
Nice, too nice. Mm-hmm. Now, Janet, I don't think she remembered a thing about Aztec, but.
She was too young.
Yeah, she was a little too young. And then I went up and down the bays, you know, with my father working on the water until about, I was 18 years old. And I come home on the weekend, and my cousin was there, and he said, Frank said, I got something to tell you. He says, you're not going to like part of it. He said, but young men like you is going to be drafted. He said, I'm pretty sure we're going to go to war. He said, and they're taking a boat. Back in those days, they took in some boats from me. They put them in the Coast Guard Reserve, they called it. Neither one of you remember that, but they took in fishing boats. If it was a pretty decent boat, they would take the boat in, and they didn't pay them for the use of the boat, but whoever owned the boat, they would give them a pretty decent rate, you know, to make up for the loss of, what their boat might make. Uh-huh. And he said, they're taking this boat in. This boat was named Susie B. And he said, Monday, this was Friday, he said, they need 2 seamen to go aboard that boat. He said, I was thinking about you and your cousin Jack. So, Monday, I was down at Little Creek, see. I think maybe a day or two after that, they swore me in in the Coast Guard's boat. You signed for 1 year. And they said at the end of the year, if nothing's happening and everything's going pretty good, you'll be discharged. But before I forget it, Mr. R.I. Hudson built this boat. She was Bob Mears. I don't know whether either one of you remembered Bob Mears or not, but he was in the seafood business on the east side. See, that's what he did for his living. See, real made a lot of money in it. See, but anyway, I asked him. I said, Bob, what did that boat cost? He said, I think it was $750. Mr. R. Hudson, you know, built it. Mm-hmm. You know, the great decoy car. And pretty little boat, pretty nice little boat, and they sailed a lot of parties, fishing parties at her. She served her purpose, really. But the thing was interesting about it, Mr. R.I. Hudson had, I don't know whether it was a flying duck or maybe it might have been a pair of ducks, but they were auctioned for $80,000, his decoys.
Wow.
His decoys today are priceless.
Mm-hmm.
Now, boat building, you don't hear much about his stuff, but he built that boat and Bob Mears and built this other little boat I was telling you about that we used to dredge oysters with my father. It was just a little dredge scale, we called it. And he put a Model A Ford engine in it, and that was the biggest help, you know, to make it a little bit of money raising our family.
Well, did you serve the year in the Coast Guard and then get out? Or?
The first place we went was to Baltimore. We tied up at Pier 4 Pratt Street. That's where right where the dolphin tank is today. Back in those days, it was a big seaport. The harbor was lined with steamers that ran up and down Chesapeake Bay, a few Navy ships and Coast Guard cutters and things like that. On the seventh day of I said December 7th is when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. And one of our men, well, I'd never heard of Pearl Harbor, so I don't remember ever hearing anything about Pearl Harbor. This, he was next to the man in charge on this boat. I was on Susie B. And he come aboard and said, man, Pearl Harbor just been bombed. Said, you might as well say we're at war. Well, anyway, we had to get out of the Coast Guard Reserve and sign in the regular Coast Guard. And they discharged us, gave us an honorable discharge, and we re-enlisted in the regular Coast Guard. And later on, we did things like patrolling all around Norfolk and Newport News and all that in these little reserve boats, what was left of them, see. But, and then I got the boat I was on caught afire, burned up. Or she didn't, it burned the cabin off, see, not the whole boat, but... And then we had to go on what they called them was an 83-footer back in those days. See, they operated out of Little Creek, and they were a wooden hull boat, the smallest Coast Guard cutter they had, see. Had a crew of about 14 or 15 men. Usually an ensign, if they had one, where they could use, was in charge. And carried 8 depth charges, a 20-millimeter a gun, see, and we had to go out about 50 miles out past Cape Henry, to patrol. We had buoys there that we worked in between them, from one buoy to the other. But anyway, that on that boat, and I forget how long it stayed. Not too long on her, but I really seen more of the war on that boat than I did because I didn't go overseas. But 2 different times I could remember, I seen them towing a ship in that was blown right into the bow part of it. And they could take it into Newport News, see, and put it in dry dock and just add right on to it, see. Mm. Freighters, most of them were. Mm-hmm. And then another time I remember seeing the stern part of the ship being towed in to Newport News. And another time I could remember seeing this big lumber board. She was maybe... 125 foot long. It was riddled with machine gun bullets, see. I asked one of the men, I said, what's this? One of the older men, he said, well, I'm pretty sure, he said, the Germans use that for target practice. And the only thing that kept this barge afloat was the lumber, it was full of lumber. And And then one morning, one of our men, just about the crack of day, he says, he saw, he went out to have a smoke, I think, out of the engine room. He was working in the engine room. He said, I saw something. We sounded general quarters, and we searched for maybe an hour, but we never did make contact with that. And I think the man must have saw a submarine, but they were just almost as fast as we were, see, because the 83-footer could only do, I think, 18 or 19 knots. Not a very fast boat. Mm-hmm. But anyway, later on, I was riding my horse on Aztec. I was home on Liberty, and I was talking to a man. His name was Mr. Harvey Beebe. He was a great man, I thought, a nice man. And him and another man one time had leave Aztec, and they were on the front of Aztec station, the old station's there now, and saw this big flash out in the ocean. And one of them looked at the other, said, we might as well get ourselves ready. They said, we're gonna be called to go to sea to pick up survivors. And that's really what they had to do. And by 20 minutes or a half hour, they got a call from the district office saying that they needed to get underway and go out and bring these people in. And that happened at least 2 times from Chincoteague. See, they went out and picked up survivors. And they were sinking. Oh, nobody really, would believe the things that was going on out in the ocean at that time. But to get back to my story again, he told me about one of the men that was serving at Aztec at that time wanted sea duty. And he wanted to know what my rate was, but I told him. He said, well, you could get a mutual swap. So this man wants sea duty in the worst way. I said, well, I'm about to swap him. So in about a month, I got up to Aztec. And one of the things that kind of interested me and made me feel good was the day that I, they sent me to ask Tiggy, it was a cold day, and or it was kind of in late fall, and this fellow came in, he was one of the old surfmen that I was telling you about, and his name was Bill Daisy, and he was a great pipe smoker, and he come in to pick me up from where Tom's Cove campground is now. We saved a little sail, you know, by coming in there, and when we got to Assateague, man, I was getting hungry, you know, been nothing to eat all day, and it was getting chilly, and to Assateague Station said they got a boathouse, and they would drop this cradle right down in the water, like a little, it was like a railroad track in a way, only this this little rig was, it looked like a little, something you'd use on a train track, see? Mm-hmm. They could drop that right down in the water, and the boat would go up on top of it, pull it right off in the boathouse. Well, Mr. Bill Daisy come in with a little bit too much speed, and he overshot the cradle. And the skipper of the station was there. His name was Mr. Elmer Lund. Oh, great, fine man. See, I'll find that out later on. And he kind of quarreled with Bill for coming in too fast. Says, you ought to know better. Says, you come in here too many times with that boat. Well, I thought, I said, boy, you got your foot in a lion's mouth. See, I thought it was going to be everything but a book. I was almost beginning to feel sorry for myself. And the second time he come in, everything perfect. And it was maybe five or six of the men waiting there on the pier. The old pier and everything after the boat was in good shape right today. And I threw my sea bag on the pier, and Mr. Elmer Lund had 33 years service. He was in charge of the station. He was chief. He come up and put his arm around me. He said, Frank, says, I'm so glad to have you here with us. He said, we really need you here bad. He said, I thought, I don't know what you need me for, but anyway, you can imagine how that made me feel, see. And that's another one of the little stories that I never, you know, I'll always remember it, because mm-hmm. he was so good to me, so kind to me, and he was a man that didn't, like myself, he wasn't too well educated, but he had a yeoman that was working for him, used to be a Chincoteague man. His name was Harry Jester, and he could, all Mr. Lund had to do was sign his name, said anything, all the paperwork, you know, but otherwise he did a great job, you know, taking care of the crew, and he told me, he said, now Frank, when I've got your supper all ready, well that sounded good to me, said, to start with, and he says, we're going to put you up in the attic. He said, well, everything we got here is full of people, see. Even a lot of men in the army spent a little bit of time there, see. They would put them to these places, and if they needed men, they knew right where to get them at, see. They knew where they had many seamen and all that. And but he said, we got your supper all ready, and we're going to put you up in the attic until we find space for you. And he was just a, you know, number one man. And it's one of the things, say, that I always remember, because it made me feel so good, you know, to have somebody like mm-hmm. him, you know, be kind to you. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty much, well, I stayed there a while, and then they had, we really volunteered for this. We told them if they needed us, me and my friend Miller Jones would go wherever we'd like to go together, but it was this brand new Coast Guard cutter they built in Curtis Bay. Her name was a Mendota. And whenever they were getting her ready to go in and commission, they sent us, to kind of shorten the story a little bit. We hadn't been to Baltimore long, say, to Curtis Bay, when her journey had surrendered. Well, that made everybody feel great. And then after the Coast Guard cutter Mendota got built, you know, we were going out making runs and checking the ISA guns and all that, see, and we had to go to gunnery school to learn how to use the 5-inch gun, not real big guns, you know, like a battleship would have, but everybody said she was going to take a part in the invasion of Japan, but We left. They wanted to take her to D.C. to kind of show her off a little bit. She was a new Coast Guard cutter. And when we left from Baltimore, we anchored out in Chesapeake Bay. Beautiful night, I'll never forget it. Truman come on the air and says that Japan had surrendered. Then about an hour he come on and he said it wasn't official. But we kept on up, I'll never forget, you know, going up past Mount Vernon and all that up Potomac River. And we got in D.C. about, I don't know, 8 o'clock that night. And Truman got on the air and said it was official that Japan had surrendered. And boy, you can imagine being in a place like D.C. and getting news like that. But we made our we made the trip to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, which kept on the same thing. I think one thing, they wanted to get rid of a lot of the ammunition and depth charges and all that, had a board of her. And we stayed down there about 6 weeks and come on home and got discharged. And that later on, I re-enlisted in the Coast Guard because I just wanted to see what it was like in peacetime. And that's the way I finished out, you know, the things that I can remember, you know. It was a little bit interesting to see. And when I re-enlisted, I got married. My wife, she's the one who passed away about 2 years ago. And but it was kind of nice being back in those stations because we were at peace, you know, Korea. But we didn't enjoy that too long because we went to war for Korea, in Korea. And when they did, of all people, to send to train some of the men, I was one lucky enough. And I hadn't even been to boot camp, see, but what I did when I got there, I was teach them how to row. And, you know, I had enough of that around the stations because we had boats, you know, we used to do that all. Made out pretty good, but did a 4-year hitch and come back and worked on the water again, mostly due to the pay being so bad, you know, no pay art in those days. But during that time, my grandparents moved over to Shinkatig, and my uncle, maybe his name was Ralph. Ralph, just a real good man. He had a little, well, if you know where Pension Street is, when you make the left to go up on Pension Street from Church Street, it was a second house there on Pension Street. You know, and upstairs, and so that's where they finished up their days. My grandfather and my grandmother, and that's about, you know, anything. And I got on the water, back on the water, you know, doing the same thing, fishing and potting crabs and things like that. But it was just you know, kind of it was an interesting life in a lot of ways, and I'll never forget my grandparents.
Now, were they there during the 62 storm?
Yeah, they were on Shinkatig then, yeah. During the storm, they took everybody, had a lot of helicopters, you know, flying back and forth. And my grandmother went to, my wife was from, I told you, from Wattsville. And she was one of the first ones to fly off on a helicopter. And she thought that was great, see, you know. But that and just the way they lived on Assateague, it was unbelievable how the Lord provided things for people. And with no money around, see, because we had plenty of food and plenty of seafood. And like I said, they cut their own wood. And it was just
quite a contrast to today.
My grandmother, her house was really, it wasn't too bad, it was really bigger than ours was, but, and that, that's just about winds it up, you know, where I remember everything.
Williams, and he's telling us about trout lining.
Trout lining crabs.
Trout lining. This is Mr. Williams. We're at his home in Atlantic, and we're talking about fishing.
Well, you can see what I was trying to tell you about, but this little old rough drawing there, see, it's this was called a hedge here, see, the fish would get in here, and if they went this way, they'd go into marsh, but if they went here, they'd go back out and get in the trap, see. And my father was real good, you know, at putting down pounds and things like that, fish pound or fish trap, see. He always called them a fish pound.
And
like a dog pound.
Yeah. That's a little old rough drawing of what it would look like if you're looking at it, you know, from side two, you could say. Mm-hmm. And if you went there and it had a lot of fish in the trap in this part here, the pocket, you had to net it out, you know, with a hand net. And as you lighten it up, you could wind up by just putting the net over in the boat and pulling the net
the
over
whole
in,
thing
and
out.
The whole thing in, And this, I think I told you about the Down to Bay boat. See, that's what when you're going down to Bay, you know, spending some time, you know.
And you have a model here.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And you say your son made this?
My son-in-law.
Son-in-law. Okay. Wow.
Okay, well. Mm-hmm. But that's exactly the way they look like. See, this is that would have been their lights, their sailing lights here, the tanks. Back here, we call this a slide. So you could, if you didn't have a way like this to get down in the cabin, you know, you'd have to get down real low. See, but this would move forward, and you could just step right down in it. See, this was called a slide, and if you understand what I'm trying to say, you just push this ahead, and you could step right down.
Uh-huh.
Had a little set of steps here. The food was kept back in here, see, because it was cooler. See, this was sitting in the water, this part of the boat here. And the water barrels, that we had to take our water in barrels, and that's the only way we could carry drinking water and water to cook with, see, is in these barrels here. And usually in my day, they had put car engines in there. That's what we use. Mm-hmm. It did pretty good.
Would the engine be here?
No, the engine sat right along
here. Oh, okay.
And see, that's the propeller and.
He did a great job.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And that's why in the summer months when you needed to put the clams down to get them out of the sun.
Uh-huh.
And it was also a little cooler, see, due to the water. You know, the surrounded by water. We call that the hole, you know, where you put your clams at and everything. And this was, we call them hatch covers.
Mm-hmm.
But that was my father. And, you know, I thought that boat was great, see. That's just a little old rough drawing, the best I can, because I wanted my granddaughter to know, have some little idea of what it looked like. You know,
it's wonderful.
All they had, said to tie their boats to, maybe was a piece of iron pipe, you know, stopped down in the marsh, and all the people lived in the Aztec. They didn't have any piers or things like that to tie their boat to, but you can give you a little rough idea of how they tied their boats, and this was the channel, like I say, off here. You could take your little boat, get right out in the channel, catch all the fish you needed. And this was a little rough drawing of how you weighted clams. See, you felt them with your feet. Did you know that?
I've done that sometimes.
Have you done it? Well, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And I got a picture of somewhere of a.
Oh.
Well, this is, you know, a rough drawing of a boat that's bringing up seed oysters, see, with the monitor loaded with oysters. That's what it looked like. You know, it looked like a hill on top of the monitor, see. And they would either be going to Chincoteague Bay with them to plant them or to Tom's Cove. Now, that's what tonguing, did you ever know how what you're talking about when you're tong clams or oysters, just like rakes, see, on the end of sticks.
Mm-hmm.
And my father, he was real good at that in his day. And this was another, that was a houseboat my father owned, and didn't have a motor in it, but you had to tow it everywhere it went, you know. We called it a floating shanty. Had three rooms in it, and you could sleep about maybe 8 or 10 people on board of a boat range like this. Had a little coal stove up here to heat, and A little three-burner kerosene stove to cook on.
Now, when you're talking about going down the bay, are you talking about going down Chincoteague Bay?
Well,
or are you talking about down the bay, the Chesapeake Bay?
No, we're talking about going down the bay, maybe it's down to Hog Island Bay, maybe it's...
Oh, okay. When you say down the bay, you mean the bays along
the... All the inland waters, see. I'll say average, you know, somewhere around Exmoor, south of that a lot of times, depending on different things, see.
Okay. So you're like going between those barrier islands on the way down?
Yeah, right. Okay. And to all those islands, I got another book in there. It's got some pictures of the Coast Guard station, see.
Down at Hog Island?
Hog Island. Uh-huh. I'll get that for you. Just take a minute. But that's one of the boats I had, work boat. I made it too long, but it was a pretty nice boat. And I could dredge clams with it, you know, or sleep three people aboard of a boat like this.
Wow.
I wish you could meet my granddaughter. She works at Circuit City, and she's a nice...
Is she up in Salisbury?
She's Richmond.
Richmond, oh, okay.
And that's a little old drawing of how we fish crab pots, and you can almost smell the water, right?
Yeah.
And this, that's kind of interesting, see. That's up until maybe 1960, a lot of people built a little, we call it watch houses, back in the marsh, and they'd maybe find some oyster ground that they thought, you know, could make some good money, and they'd built a little one-room house on stilts, just like that is.
Mm-hmm.
And so they caught their water off of the roof, see, and...
I see. It's draining down into the water barrel.
But that's there was a lot of them down the bay, you know, we're going down the bay back in my day, see.
So they would stay in there and...
Yeah.
Do their oystering and then head home.
Yeah, they could. Uh-huh. Well, they could watch the grind mostly. See, what the little house, you know, it's just a little one-room shack was about all it was.
Yeah, they didn't want anybody stealing their oysters.
Yeah, right. That was the idea.
They were watching them. Great that you've done some of this for her.
My handwriting is terrible.
Looks pretty good to me.
Now, that's just a little old rough drawing of this boat I was telling you about, Susie B.
Oh, when you were in the Coast Guard.
Yeah,
Pretty
little boat. She had what they call a trunk cabin. You know, that was... The cabin was not raised up above the decks. It was the top part of the boat. The sides of the boat were made high enough so you could live beneath the decks.
Beneath
the
deck,
But it was a pretty little boat, and the thing that interested me as much as anything was the fact that Mr. R. Hudson built this boat, and his decoys were so much in demand.
He was quite a craftsman.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, he was a nice man too, Mr. Hudson was. And that's the boat, you know, I was telling you about that caught a fire with me. That's another.
Oh.
But, you know, not even near to what they really looked like. But it'll give
my
granddaughter a little idea, you know, of what things
are. Sure will, because it's so different today.
Yeah. Another thing I'm trying to find here. Well, that's just a rough drawing of the 83-footer I was on, see. Only the vertical. The bow is pretty good, but I couldn't, you know. And if it takes a long, see, it's a little 20-millimeter gun I was telling you about. That's depth charges.
Looks mighty small to take out all the German Army or Navy.
Yeah, about that, yeah. And the crew... Slap up in here. You could operate it from down below or up on the bridge, see. And in their day, they were pretty nice. I remember telling my father that how expensive they were. They were 80, $1,000 a foot, these boats were. Oh, my Lord, this day and time, that wouldn't be nothing,
mm-mm,
see.
Mm-mm. No.
I got a picture of an oyster pond here I want to show you if I can.
Well, you're so thoughtful to have done this for your grandchildren, granddaughter.
There's another picture of the old boat with seed oysters. And this was a drawing of the Dying to Bay boat. You know, the way they would look, if you could look right down in them, see?
Mm-hmm. The bunks
that's,
and everything.
That's the bunks here, bunk here, bunk here, the pilot house bunk. Well, I don't think I had that there, but back under the stern, see, that's why we had to keep our food. It kept a little better there than it would have. And this is the hole here, see?
Mm-hmm.
But that'd be a little help to her, you know, to.
Mm-hmm.
This, not too many people knew what an oyster pond was, see, but back in my father's day, they would go like from Pontiac Creek, see, this would be the creek right here,
mm-hmm.
And they would dig a trench inland and dig out this big pond, see. I don't know how they managed to do it hardly, because it had to be a lot of digging, but and this little trench would let the amount of salt water in this pond they needed. To keep the oysters, you know, a little fresh water with an oyster improves the growth and the taste and everything, see.
Mm.
And they would put them in there, and when the weather turned cold, or, you know, and the bays froze up and all that, they would have a lot of oysters on hand, see. And that's when they would take them down to the freight dock and put everything on the boats, and they would go to Franklin City. Because the railroad track runs right. Have you ever go to Franklin City? It's like a little point that runs right down in the water, and it's the old railroad track is still there. But they would back the horse and wagon down here. They put a bucket under the horse's tail.
Okay.
Anyway, and you know that's a rough drawing of an oyster pond. You know, not many people have heard about that. See, but
no.
My father used to tell me stories. And they were real clean with it. He said every fall they would go in there with big wide brooms and they'd sweep all the silt and everything out here to where this drain is and push it all out in the creek to get rid of it. And they would haul in fresh sand and every year in the fall of the year. And then they would put their oysters in there.
So this farming oysters is not a new thing. They really had to take care of your beds even in the olden times.
Oh, yeah. You uh-huh. needed to, uh-huh, yeah. And you had to, every spring, you had to, they put out screwbore pots. The screwbore is like a little periwinkle, and they would kill the oysters, see, if they were on your oyster beds. And somebody said they had like an acid in them, and they could drill a little hole in an oyster shell. Used to, no trouble, toss it, sit a little hole, and that would kill the oyster. It killed, always killed thousands of bushels of oyster, a little screwbore, like a little periwinkle. And every year they would scrape the ground, you know, with flat bars and dredges. That was one way of getting rid of them. And all the shells and things you would bring ashore, so you just put them on the your dock or wherever you need them, they would dry it, and the screwbores would kill the screwbores. The only thing, like a sailboat, that I can remember was something like this here, see, it was something like the Dying to Bay boats, a lot of Dying to Bay boats were old sailboats at one time, and, but this boat here was, well, we call it Die, see, they booted up the creek and just left it there till it just sank and it just lay there, see. And, but it had a little low cabin, see. This was kind of a little drawing of something like the Dying to Bay boat, see. But had little bunks down each side, little low bunks. And this would be a little small table. The aid officer was hooked to the stern part of the boat. Oh, the table wasn't about one-third the size of this table here, say, but mm-hmm. it was just big enough so everybody could set a plate on it, you know, and eat their meal. Hmm. And but I don't remember. That's the only thing I remember, and I had to guess about a little bit of it, but
well, you've really,
a very good drawing.
I don't know. I think you're pretty good. I wouldn't tell anybody that you're not. They look good to me. Well.
And that was just a rough, that was a terrible drawing of the picky boats we used to have, see. But there was only about five windows, and I didn't think about it till I...
That's at the lifeboat station. Uh-huh. Oh, picket boat.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, they had a lightship off... that was a picture made out of the Cobble. It was...
Oh.
And this guy here and him is from Pittsburgh.
Hmm.
They went to school together and went through boot camp together and were all stationed together at one time.
Wow. You've really had a very interesting life.
Yeah, it has been, uh-huh. And that we had a light ship, say, for a while, a light ship. Well, if you would go up now to Aztec and go where the office is and all that, and where most of the bathing and all that's done, and you steer due east for about maybe I'll say however, I forgot how long it takes to go to her. And it was a big sand shoal off there, and that's the winter quarter light ship stayed there. And of course, she had a light and.
Yeah. Neat. But did anybody stay on her?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
oh, yeah, they did.
Crew on her all the time. Yeah, back in those days, they stayed there in hurricanes and all kinds of bad weather, see, on those light ships. This.
Okay, well, I think we've learned a lot here.
Well, that's about it so far as I can tell you. You know, that's...